Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for October 6, 2022. Heading into the home stretch this year, an entire year of programming dedicated to the history of the discoveries of my work, along with the discussion of what those discoveries are and how they fell into history, are some of the, you know, let's just put it this way, the concepts and my philosophies that go along with this and how I've developed over time, having to react to a world that is so corrupt and dishonest, trying to bring forth honesty and true science, etc. And then in a world where you have tier two scientists who have no clue of that, that everything they're doing is just ridiculous fairy tale science, and that there's an entire level of science above them of which they know nothing. And, you know, these people go on, they're just, you know, they're literally in Alice in Wonderland, fairy tale, la la land. So anyway, that has caused me to be very, progressive in explaining this to the public. And so, unfortunately, it takes a lot of time. But when you understand this, then a lot of other things make sense. And now one of those issues has to do with something called peer review. Peer review is a process that has been set up over, let's say, scientifically in recent times, and used to be that if somebody wanted to publish a paper, they would go to advisors or other people well-known in the field and then get feedback, etc., and that feedback would eventually be public common knowledge. But then peer review went dark, in which you don't know who the peer review scientist is that's reviewing your paper, who's making these comments. And so it became a way for scientists to, in secret, bolster themselves, steal the work of other people, prevent other people from publishing, and to do it in this honorary way, in which it's all just a glowing success. And so, unfortunately, science that is 100 years old is still being promulgated in the peer-reviewed journals. And, of course, as I said, if you get up to Tier 1, they don't publish. They don't publish in peer-reviewed journals. You never see their name. They never publish. So real science is not published in peer-reviewed journals. Tier 2 science is, and it's maintained to keep the status quo, because why would a scientist who has his work published in peer-reviewed journals, etc., why would he allow a new idea to come in that basically alters or even wipes out his long-achieved peer-reviewed list of articles, sometimes hundreds of articles on a given topic, and especially when you get to the terms and topics like cosmology or the Big Bang or the dirty snowball or electrical nature of the universe or that gravity is the only force forming the universe, etc. All of these things are guarded, and they, so this has brought about what I call the axioms of astronomy. That if you, and this was this was from a letter that I got from the early days when I was at Cornell. I was publishing in these European journals and edited by the editor-in-chief of the journals themselves and put right into publication, something that rarely happens. But the scientist, this editor, knew the importance of my work. And then he got all of this backlash. And when he got the backlash, he wrote me a letter and he said, it seems like astronomy is a religion, that if you don't agree with this dirty snowball thing, which at the time was called ice ball comet model, or the Big Bang, etc., if you don't ascribe to these axioms, then they don't want you to publish. And so that's where I ran in. I just completely obliterated those ideas. But of course, peer review is something that is still in existence today and does not allow change. So I wrote a subpage And it's very important to understand the context of that subpage. On my webpage, it's called Peer Review Critique Subpage. And so anyway, I'm going to go through these, and it's really putting these into perspective because this very much affects the world of science. If the publication system in science is broken, then how can there be science? And this has been broken for a very long time. Remember, it was broken when I was at Cornell. This is like 43 years ago. And it's still broken, and it hasn't changed at all. And that's a reflection also of the scientific community, because the science has not advanced at all. And you would think that there would be new revelations, something new and exciting, and literally nothing. There's still, you know, it's not worth talking about. But you have to understand the reasons why peer review, I just don't have anything to do with it. And so anyway, I'll go through these. I'll simplify them a little bit. But basically, why would I submit a groundbreaking work that has been verified by space probe data to journals refereed by scientists who are lost in the cave ages with outdated incorrect theories and whom have PhDs in totally incorrect fairy tale science? In other words, you are submitting... Now, these people are supposedly the experts in the field, and that's the definition of peer review. The definition is that somebody who is experienced, that is knowledgeable in the field, is then going to review it to make sure that it's proper, that it has all the I's dotted and the T's crossed. That's part of peer review. And then also that it is correct. And so, like they told me when I was at Cornell, we only teach correct physics here. No, everything they were teaching was broken. And I'm not talking about freshman 101 gravity or electronics. I'm talking about space science and the concepts of space science, which were totally flawed. Okay, the other thing is that journals take control of the work of the publications, and one would have to ask permission. So when I publish, for example, the two papers that I do have that are peer-reviewed in astrophysics journals, I had to ask permission from the publishers, from those journals. I had to write a letter and get a letter back stating that I had permission to publish my own work. Now, I'm an independent scientist. I don't have any government publish or perish. I'm not on a tenure track where I have to have this work in my record for my position or something like that. And so that's the trap that these scientists are in, and they are slaves because the publication system, guess who owns that? It's the same banker system in which all of these scientists, they're tier two scientists, so it's mainly garbage scientists, garbage science. But when they submit a paper for publication, part of that is that the ownership of that paper is with the journal, and I don't do that. The reality is that very little real research is published in peer-reviewed journals. If you go to private corporations, if you go to companies that are developing new methodologies, chemistries, physics, applications, etc., they don't peer-review. Tier one science, the military, what I call military science, because usually it is handled through the military, etc. Tier one science is never, ever published in a peer-reviewed journal. You don't see it. You don't see who the authors would be or the scientists. They simply do not. Everything they do is internal to their own systems, but they never, ever submit to peer review. And just that word, submit. Just the word submit. Do you submit your work? Submit means subservience. Submit means to kneel down and raise up your work and say, oh, please take my work and put it in print, and I will gladly give it to you, and have absolutely no ownership of my work. Any patent rights, etc., that come out of this will not be mine. No, I don't do that. I'm not going to play that game. And so really, there are very little research is published in peer-reviewed journals. Next, the peer-reviewed system is just plain flawed. It is necessary to keep the riffraff out because there's a lot of garbage science and a lot of idiots out there that think that they should be able to publish in journals, but really don't have anything to say. And so, and they really don't know how to write. I mean, it would be a huge mess. So you do have to keep the riffraff out of publications, which is a problem. But then the entire system is turned into protectionism for the few people that are in this system. So it becomes an ivory tower system in which the peer review process, including the cycle of funding, government top-down grants, research driven by top-down edict, proclamation via peer review, which is monopolized by the same groups that move and get the government funding for the next year. The system is a flawed, and it's run by monopoly groups. So some politicians, for example, think that if you spend more on science, it will expand and grow and you'll get more. But really what happens is you empower the monopoly groups, and then they just become more protective, because the more money there is, the more protective they have to become. And really, scientists today are like squirrels that have forgotten how to forage for food. They live in the park and all the people come and feed them. And the government is funding science. Scientists have forgotten how to go out and create science. What they do exactly, and by the way, I'm doing this for historical purposes. So in 100 years or in 500 years or 30 years, people can look back and understand really what's going on here. But when a scientist today at a university or whatever wants to get grant money, he doesn't sit down and think, wow, if I invented this or if I did this or made this improvement, I would really be doing great research. No, what they do is they take a book that is published by the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of Health, and they look at it and they look through it and they're, here's a topic. Okay, this is related to something I can do. This is a effort that the government scientists and these government agencies, they say, this is where we want research to go. So they design areas, critical areas, where they want scientific research. And so the scientist out in the university goes through that and he goes, okay, I'm going to set a proposal for this. And they send out, and they might send out 20 or 30 proposals, and they get four or five back where they get grant money. And of course, it's based on their past history of success, etc. And what's success? It's publications. So it's a cycle of publish, funding, government, basically influence in the government with scientists, so they know the handshake of the scientist that's working in the university. And it's this cycle, and then publication, and this goes on and on. And it does not allow for innovative science. It squelches innovative science. And the next point, Einstein only published two papers in peer-reviewed journals, both in Germany and when he came to the U.S. He was openly critical of the peer review system for the exact same reasons that I'm talking about here. Most real research is literally conducted in private. And personally, I have always worked alone. I control my own work, my own research, my own funding. I do not submit for approval to anyone. And also, I'm very critical of my own work. So I peer review my own work, and I'm much more demanding on my own work than somebody who would be an anonymous peer reviewer in a journal. And really, it's a bad system. The peer-reviewed system is broken. The peer-review journals are the epitome of Tier 2 science. And my work is understood in Tier 1 levels as the top level of science. And so when, for example, I was approached by Tier 1 scientists on many different occasions, they'd come out and talk to me, they will inevitably say, we don't know how you determine, how do you find all of these discoveries how you work in so many different fields. You don't have government funding. You don't have a lab. You don't have staff. You don't have secretaries. You don't have graduate students working for you. And you're on the cutting edge of all these different fields. And that's because I'm aware of the history of science. I know where things have been. I know where things have to go. I'm not beholden to some book from the National Science Foundation to figure out what I'm going to study next year. Okay, so also the thing is that scientists have lost control of their work. They have to publish within a certain framework, and none of them conduct research that they designed. And I'll also mention, once again, my 11 mega world projects that are necessary for the survival of the human race. None of this will be ever submitted to peer-reviewed journals. Here's a story that I've talked about before, but it has to do with peer review, so I'm including it here. When I was on the faculty of Cornell University, I submitted a paper to Icarus, the Cornell Space Science Journal, for which a joker named Joseph Burns was the acting editor. Carl Sagan was the editor, but he just happened to be at the time in Hollywood making the Cosmos series. And so my paper that I submitted was the Saturn Sweeper Moons paper, which was published in a European space science journal, as I've talked about before. But it was originally submitted to Icarus, which is the Cornell Space Science Journal, Joe Burns, acting editor. Joe Burns wrote me a letter of basically he did not let it go out to peer review, but just sent me a letter himself and said, there's no need to assume electrical fields or moons in the gaps of Saturn's rings, that all of this was understood. These rings had been there since the beginning of the solar system, and there was no need to implement what I was suggesting, the moons in the rings. So later, very soon after my paper was actually published, the Saturn sweeper moons were literally discovered doing exactly what I said, and I called them sweeper moons. Joe Burns takes my terminology and my work and then becomes the NASA expert on Saturn sweeper moons. So basically, here a guy who's peer-reviewing my article at the supposedly a respectable peer-reviewed journal, Icarus, of Cornell University, steals my work. The peer-review scientist steals my work while he's reviewing my paper, after he turns it down and says it's not viable. Okay, and then finally, I like this line. This is one of my catchphrases about peer review, that peer review is like an old man driving slow in the left lane of a crowded freeway. He has plenty of room in front of him. He just can't figure out why all those people are honking and trying to get around him. And that's peer review in a nutshell. It's like, oh, okay. You know, this guy gets the paper. It takes months for them to review it. He might send it to other people for secondary opinions. You don't know who's getting to see your paper. And especially if it's innovative, everybody wants to have a piece of it, because let me tell you something, good original work in the science community is very rare and far between, especially something innovative as my work, something that just is totally different than the standard paradigm and replaces the standard paradigm. And so what do they want to do? It's something, it's a term I developed, it's called the creeping crud. Creeping crud is where NASA takes my work and then, first of all, denies it, and then copies it and tries to work it into their baloney science, terminology, etc. And it's constant. It has been constant over the decades. So the creeping crud is just a way of stealing people's work while preventing them from publishing in the so-called respectable peer-reviewed journals. So peer review does not work. The other issue is that scientists are literally compromised. Let me explain the lifetime cycle of a scientist, of a new PhD scientist. A new PhD, they go to college, they typically go to grad school immediately afterwards. That's not like me, where I took 3 years off and then came back to grad school and got a worldly education. No, they go right into grad school. So they're green behind the ears. They've never done anything in their life. They've never had a real job. They live in this ivory tower. They all go off to grad school, and they're totally indoctrinated with what they're taught. They don't see anything else. They're kept extremely busy getting that PhD. And what, the biggest thing they learn is they have to repeat what their advisor tells them. So they become carbon copies of their advisors. And so, okay, you're getting up close to getting a PhD. You're probably married by now. You got a kid or two. You know, the people, your family has been living in squalor because you're getting a PhD. And now you get an opportunity. You do your thesis. That's a year, maybe a year and a half of grueling work. Then your professor takes your work and publishes under his name. And then, okay, so once you submit to this, all of this, you know, cruelty and abnormal behavior, then you get your PhD, and now you get to have a what they call a postdoc, an after doctorate position, usually very low pay, and then you have to move. So your family has to be uprooted, move to some other place, and now a postdoc is a year or two position to see if you can cut the mustard after you've gotten your PhD. So there you're doing usually work under somebody else. If there's a publication, if you're lucky, you might get your name at the end of a list of 10 people. And so this is a way of letting you know that you're the bottom feeder. And the bottom feeder is a fish that feeds off the bottom. That's where all of the junk and poop and everything else falls down at the bottom of a lake or river. The bottom feeder goes around and scoops up all of that, and that's what the food is for the bottom feeder. So a graduate student postdoc is a bottom feeder in the trough of science. And you have to submit to this. And then if you're lucky, one out of maybe every three at that position get to have a tenure track position in a university. So there again, you're uprooted, you have to move, and the competition is very tough at that point. You have to get grant money, you have to start writing papers. And these people typically teach the coursework. They have absolutely no interest in teaching. They come into a classroom, they mumble, they write something on the board, and they run out because their interest is not in teaching. And this is at the biggest so-called best universities. This is what I experienced at Cornell. This is why the students loved me, because I was a teacher. I was there teaching and putting a lot of attention towards teaching, where their standard teachers did not spend any time and giving them any attention. Okay, so the tenure track professor has 2, 3 to 5 years to produce. And at the end of that time or any time before then, they can say, you know, you're just not producing here. You're not getting that grant money in. And at, for example, at Cornell, they had probably 4 to 5 times the amount of funding coming into the university in terms of government grants as they did in terms of undergraduate tuition. So is it a teaching institute or is it a research institute? Well, let me tell you, the money speaks, and it's not a teaching institute, I can tell you that. Teaching, the students pay a lot of money to go there, and what they're really paying for is that degree, because the Cornell degree has a lot of value put on it. So they pay a lot of money, they get that degree, and then they're off into the real, so-called real world. But the professor, the tenure-track professor, is under the gun, and they sleep, and they don't sleep, they don't do anything, and their family once again suffers drastically. And they don't work on any original research. They're always at the tail end of somebody else's work. They're always, and these professors, once they get up into the pecking order, once they get tenure, once they get up, you know, to, by this time, they're 35 years old, going on 40. Do you think that they're going to rock the boat and come along with some avant-garde theory about anything? No. No, they are going to toe the party line till the cows come home, because Doggone it, it's only another 10 years to retirement. Another 10 to 15 years, and they're making $100,000, $120,000 a year, very good salary at this point. Finally, their family has a place to live. The kids can go to college. They can pay for the home and the mortgage, you know, and, you know, do you think they are going to rock the boat? No, not at all. And very rarely, if these people are really good, and this typically happens when they're very young, if they're really good, and this is very rare, like I say, they are plucked out into Tier 1 science where they sign contracts, non-disclosure agreements, and from that point on, they become an invisible person in the scientific world, never to be heard from again. And you know, they have a lifetime of science, etc., but they are sequestered. They are prisoners. And most people don't understand this until they're in the system. But the only word you can use for any of these people from the time they enter graduate student status as a young graduate student to the time they're 65 years old, they are compromised. And I never did that. I never bought into those systems, never did that. I worked as an independent scientist, and that's why I can work in many fields. That's why I own my own work. That's why I publish my own work when I want, the amount of material that I want. And what you see, the publications, the material that goes out on either the radio show or the education package or the other books, CDs, DVDs, etc., that's about maybe one-tenth of the work that I'm working on. That's what I want the public to see. And if you can digest that, you have done a lot. You have come a very long way. And by the way, what I find when I talk to people who have, they write in or people send me things and occasionally have a comment or something, I find that a lot of people really are not 100% understanding what I'm doing. And so that's okay because it's the general public. But my books, my information is available for the general public and for people who are very advanced. There are people who are very advanced that read my work and they're able to read it on that level. And so now I want to switch gears a little bit and I want to talk about the 11 Earth mega projects that I have. I'm going to go into those a little bit. And then also the talk show hosts that, for example, James Jancic, Brad Smith, Alex Merklinger, Chuck Schrammick, and talk about these particular talk show hosts that I had been on their show regularly throughout this period. And we're talking about the year 2000 to 2010, somewhere in that time frame. And of course, after that, some of these talk show hosts I was on regularly with. So many, many different shows, and I'll be talking about some particular ones. But of course, this is a main area of distribution of my discoveries, my work, etc. Sometimes releasing books, sometimes releasing information, sometimes talking about things like, say, Comet Holmes. One of the things that I predicted was that Comet Holmes would very much excite as a comet once there was a special alignment. I think it was Mars, Venus, Mercury, and Comet Holmes. And Comet's Holmes was coming right in behind Mars and just on cue exploded into brightness. It became literally in the sky as big as the full moon physically. When you looked at the sky, it was there, visible to the naked eye. And so I'll be talking about that and some of the information I put out to the public during those times through radio shows. So very important to understand the different radio shows. And some, just an interesting little quip here, Brad Walton was a talk show host with WCCO Radio Television in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's the big, I think they call it Channel 4, and I don't know what the call numbers are, WCCO Radio, 830, I think it was, 830 a.m. on the AM dial. And of course, late at night, those big AM stations crank up the power, and broadcast nationally. So I would pre-record a show, a 2 or 3 hour show with Brad Walton, and that would air on WCCO, national distribution. And then I would be on the Coast to Coast AM radio show the same night with George Norrie. And so I would have the two major radio station outlets nationally, one live and one pre-recorded, all airing at the same time. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to actually go to the Coast to Coast AM webpage where my appearances are cataloged, and they start out at April 21st, 2003. And, of course, this is with host George Norrie. Previously, I had been on Art Bell's show back into the mid-1990s. This is back in the Hale Bopp days, etc. So what we're looking at here is the Coast to Coast AM with Clear Channel, which is George Norrie's host. So that's the first date they have here, and it says James McCanney, researcher of celestial mechanics and plasma physics, Monday night's guest. Comets are not dirty snowballs, but electrical vacuum cleaners that are drawing in material, and the big ones can retain material with their gravitational fields, become bigger, etc. And so each show gives its description. And here's one, May 16th, 2003, which is interesting. That's the day after the May 15th, 2003, We're All Gonna Die, Crazy Lady Talks to Aliens. And I'm on the night after that, and this is the description, theoretical physicist James McCanney appeared in the first half Friday night show to discuss the ideas about Planet X. While he doesn't subscribe to the notion that a rogue planet is headed this way in the next several weeks, he does believe there is evidence, etc. And of course, at that point, it was still unclear to me that NASA knew about, at least the higher-ups at NASA, knew about Hale-Bopp all the time, that, in fact, it was the same object that Harrington discovered, and that I eventually determined, etc. And so here we are, Friday the 13th, 2003, that was June 13th, July 7th, 2003, I released the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And I talked about this, this particular show, July 7th, 2003, because when George Norrie read the title of that book on the radio show on the air, it went into orbit. I sold $42,000 worth of that book in one night. And it had previously sold prior to the show, prior to anybody knowing that what the title even was. And so anyway, I'm just going to read up through another set of these. Let's see, we've got 2003, we've got August 14th, August 18th, September 20th, 2003, talking about weather, extreme weather, maverick physicist James McCanney. And this was with, in fact, Art Bell. And so this was a Saturday night show with Art Bell, where he would come in and take over some of the shows on the weekend. And then here we got November 7th, 2003, November 24th, 2003, The Search for Atlantis. And let's see, February 24th, 2004, so starting right away in 2004. Let me just go up the list here. And there's one I'm particularly looking for here. Bible Prophecy, Hurricane Ivan, Comets and Electrical Energy, December 12, 2004. And I'm skipping over quite a few of them here. Did We Go to the Moon? And this was a Thursday night show. Weather, Tsunamis, and Atlantis. Here we go. Back from his trip to the South Pacific, physicist James McCanney discussed his observations related to weather, geology, and tsunamis, as well as addressing the sun, Velikovsky, and Atlantis, etc. So at any rate, okay, now here's the Velikovsky debate, and this is something I think you should all go listen to, March 30th, 2005. And so this is a hallmark show one that was highly publicized prior to its airing, and had a huge audience. But here's the read-up. It's Velikovsky Debate, March 30th, 2005. And the way this started is George Norrie called me up and he said, James, we want to have the debate between you and a top NASA scientist. Are you willing to do this? And I said, sure, bring it on. Let's put the gloves on. And what it reads is physicist James McCanny and NASA astrobiologist Dr. David Morrison debated the merits of Emmanuel Velikovsky's theories and of a chaotic universe, etc. And then there's more detail here. But March 30th, 2005, the great Velikovsky debate, which I won on the air with a call-in vote, which I thought I would just lose by 1,000,000 to 0. Okay, so anyway, then we're going on through 2005. Earth Changes Roundtable. Here we got Jim Birkeland, geologist, preparedness expert Stan Deo, physicist James McCanny, joined together for a roundtable discussion of current and upcoming Earth changes. The panelists concurred that there is a correlation between solar activity and earthquakes, weather and other, etc. Okay, here we go. Stardust. This is a maverick physicist. This is January 17, 2006. Physicist James McCanny. We turn to discuss the Stardust mission, as well as many Planet X objects and in the solar system, etc. And let's see. Well, I'm looking for another one here. Comets and Catastrophes. This is March 19, 2006. I'm looking for one in particular. It's a July show. And I'm just skipping over dozens of these shows now. Planet X, Solar Flares and Energy, and where they talk about end times, etc. I'm on this show. It's February 16, 2011. Now, here's the show I was looking for. I wanted to express a little detail on this one. July 4th, 2005. So here we are. This is the Deep Impact show, in which I'm the main guest talking about this. And this had been predicted. I had been on a show months earlier saying that this deep impact data would be available. NASA promised that it would release the data in real time. So it was supposed to be available for this show. The deep impact mission was to send a probe to a comet and then send an impactor into the comet, and then there's supposed to be ice and snow coming blasting off the comet nucleus. But when it happened, NASA refused to release the data. So here I'm on the show, we're waiting for the data, George Norrie's waiting, we're all expecting this data, and NASA doesn't produce. In fact, it was 6 months later until they produced the actual visible data, which should have been available right away. And that was what they finally showed was there was no ice or water. It was just dust that came out of this explosive event. And there was an electrical discharge, a big flare right before the impactor hit, before it hit the comet. So it did the electrical discharge, very much visible. And, of course, NASA denied it. But I'll just read the notes here. Physicist James McCanny joined the show, commenting that a lot of the data isn't in yet. Still, from what we've seen so far, there's no visible ice, water, or snow in the comet nucleus, suggesting that the dirty snowball model is wrong, as he has previously argued. And then, oddly enough, they had Richard Hoagland, who is a regular guest on Coast to Coast, and astronomer Tom Van Flandern. So Tom Van Flandern is on the same show as I am, talking about this this comet and the mission, the deep impact mission to the comet, where Van Flandern's theory is about exploded planets. Rather than dirty snowballs, comets are made up the same material as asteroids, which form during the explosion of planets, said Van Flandern. And so anyway, Van Flandern is talking about, basically in a sense supporting me. And then in the last 2 hours, Richard Hoagland and myself take phone calls. And of course, Richard Hoagland goes way back to the Art Bell days also. And one time I called up and I was talking to the producers at Coast to Coast. And she looked up and on the list and she said, you know, you've been on here more than Richard, which is, a lot of time. So I've been on there a lot. And so anyway, I wanted to make mention of that because it was one of the shows that conclusively confirmed the plasma discharge comet model, my comet model, and conclusively disproved the dirty snowball comet model. Anyway, back to the listings, and I'll just quick go through these. I'm not going to go on. It was up to about 2011, I think, where we left off. Planet X, solar flares, energy, gravity, UFOs, and Mars. Physicist Jay McCanny talked about Comet Elenin, which was a famous comet back in the day, related topics. And let's see, so we have December 2011, May 31st, 2012, and January 2013, starting out in 2013, March 2013, May 2013, May 26th, 2020, Planet X Technology Innovation. Professor James McKenna discussed Planet X and his technological innovations. Energy grid, I'm on talking about the energy grid. Professor James McKenna on gaining energy independence, etc. And so then up to 1921. My appearance is there, and of course they introduced me. This is somewhat of a standard introduction that a lot of talk show hosts have picked up. It's a good one. It says, Professor James McKenna has taught the following mathematics courses at the university level, in addition to physics, computer science, and astronomy. So the math course is abstract algebra, linear algebra, matrix algebra, probability and statistics, statistics for computing, mathematical logic, theory of numbers, calculus 1, 2, and 3, engineering math 1 and 2, advanced topics in geometry and topology. He has worked about half his lengthy career in private industry. Much of this was accomplished in multilingual settings, having worked in the USA, Latin America, and with high-level Russian scientists. He has presented his research at international conferences and is a regular presenter at American Geophysical Union meetings. He has also lectured at Los Alamos National Laboratories, the Airspace America International Air Show, and International Electric Propulsion Conferences. Understanding his background is important in placing his new book into perspective. And so then they list all my books, etc., that's a little bit of a summary of Coast to Coast. You know, a major national radio show where in these circles, my name is a household common name. And, of course, known in the industry by the people that don't like me also, much to their chagrin when people like me have an outlet where I just have a platform to talk about my topics freely. And of course, that's one great thing. It's still the United States. We can do that. But there's a lot of pressure to squelch my message to the public. Okay, moving on. James Jancic, James Arthur Jancic, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Now, he interviewed me, I just can't even imagine how many times, probably dozens of times, I'll just use a round number, and about, of course, my work. And he was a good, very good talk show host. He understood my work and delved into the topics, went into, deep into these topics. And that's one thing, too, about these talk show hosts. I have to give them credit because when I do my show, I talk about my work, I talk about my topics, etc., and I really don't have guests. But when these people have guests, that are variable. Every time it's a new guest, then they have to go out and research and understand who their guest is. What are they saying? What are their idiosyncrasies? What is the, you know, what do other people say about their work, etc.? So they have to be really conscious. So somebody like Nori or Jancic, or I'll be talking about Brad Walton, these people just have a real talent for understanding and just absorbing material out of all of these different avenues of philosophy and science and, you know, just a wide range of topics. Now, most of these people I've never met personally. I just know their voice or, of course, see their picture on the radio. But George Nori, I met personally in the studio in Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles at the Universal Studios. I was filming a History Channel special called Apocalypse Now. I think that was the name of this. It was a six-part series. You can probably still see it on the channels, the cable channels. It still airs. I have people coming up to me and saying, "Hey, I saw you on TV," you know, and I usually know that's what it amounted to. Although I've been on some other television shows, but that's usually the one that they saw. And so when that was, I was in Los Angeles doing that. And then I had another event in Los Angeles at the same time. And then at the time I was talking about doing a show with George Nori, and they said, "Why don't you come over to the studio and do a live in-studio show?" Because they wanted to have in-studio guests. Now, this is in the middle of the night up in Los Angeles. And so I had to drive over in, of course, a secure building to get in. And so they late at night, I go up there. Tom, the producer, is there, and George. And so I go in the studio, and that night George was releasing his book, Talking to the Dead. And so he had a copy of the book, and we took some pictures of us in the studio there. And so that's very interesting, because you meet the host personally, and I got to talk to George offline, and we were talking about personal things, and he knows about my personal life, and it was interesting. I won't go into any details, but it's interesting when you meet the talk show host, or the talk show host meets the guest in person, because it's like you become good friends. And of course, with all of these shows, Nori knows me very well. When we come on there, it's like old friends talking. Same with James Jancic, although I've never personally met James Jancic, but Brad Walton, I met personally because he lived up in the Twin Cities. He was a very popular talk show host, one of the most popular in the history of WCCO radio. And, of course, I was a special guest with him, and he would read my work. Every time I came out with a new book, he would read it and have me on for a special show just to talk about that, whether it was Calculate Primes or... And some of those I actually have posted on my webpage as part of the presentation of that work, because he went into such good detail. But I met Brad, and so I met him. I knew him personally. And then one day I was trying to get a hold of him, and I couldn't. And then I found out that he had passed away. He was on a vacation, and I think he was in like a store shopping, and just that's where he ended, right there. But once again, a very good talk show host. And so it's kind of a blessing to be able to get to know these people. Back in the early 2000s, Alex Merklinger, a big, big national radio show, and I was on his show a lot, and probably sometimes a couple times a week even. I mean, I was just really on his show a lot. And a lot of those shows I have taped on the old cassette tape type of recordings. And so a lot of those shows are there. And then Chuck Schrammick was the guy who had sent one of the photographs of Hale Bopp to Art Bell. And Art Bell posted it. The other guy was Courtney Brown. Those were the photos that Art posted on his webpage, which started this whole colossal event of Hale Bopp having a companion, and was it alien? And I'm just not going to go into all of those details, but it was like an explosive national event in which they accused Art Bell of being responsible for the the so-called suicide of these 37 people, which was turned out not to be a suicide. It was a mass murder. And I hate to talk about this on the air, but these events happened. But Chuck Schrammick was a talk show host from Houston, Texas, in the, you know, the heart of NASA, one of the NASA big cities, NASA Houston. Remember, NASA Houston, you know, Apollo 13 to Houston, we have a problem. Houston is a big NASA center. Chuck Schrammick was a talk show host in Houston and was very anti-NASA. He would talk about NASA, etc. And then he started having me on his show. And, of course, now the one of those shows I have posted on my webpage. And I have a hard time keeping it up there because somebody keeps taking it down. But anyway, Chuck, shortly thereafter, died of the same type of cancer as Robert Harrington died of, a sudden onset cancer. And so we don't really know much about it other than he was gone. You know, he was gone. His webpage was gone. And, you know, the only way he has a legacy sometimes is through a person like myself, who recounts who he was, what he did, how he managed to keep, how he managed to weather the storm, where, in fact, he was one of the people that took a picture of Hale Bopp with the companion. And then Hale Bopp became much bigger, and the companion was no longer visible outside of the coma. Eventually, the companion became part of the nucleus because of the tail drag. When I was on the Alex Merklinger show, I mean, this was back in the early 2000s. We were talking about Planet X. We were talking about chemtrails, etc., and on and on and on. So I released with the Brad Walton, for example, the Comet Holmes incident, which hopefully I'll have a minute to talk about here. Released the Calculate Primes book, the Diamond Principle book, and also some other discussions of esoteric topics. Rick Martin was had a webpage, a big webpage, and that's still on the internet. You can see those interviews with Rick Martin and myself back in the early Planet X days, and that's when it was very clear that NASA was hiding information about a Planet X object coming into the solar system, which I later found out was, in fact, the nucleus of Hale Bopp. Then I had my amateur astro project. I'll go into that in a little bit of detail. And then I did have some guests on my show, and I want to talk briefly about them because it's very rare that I have guests. But a couple guests I had, very important. One was Mark Gaffney, a longtime friend. I met Mark a long time ago, but Mark is the person who began the first Earth Day. Though I don't even know when this was, back in the 70s, maybe probably in the 60s. And he was at, I think, the University of Colorado in Boulder, started the first Earth Day, and now that's, of course, a big international event. He was a writer. He's written on various esoteric topics, and his latest venture is into the understanding all of the physical effects on Earth that indicate that Earth had a severe pole shift. And, of course, that corroborates with my work. And so, anyway, I had Mark as a guest on my show. And then somebody else I want to talk about, very important person who has a major YouTube channel. It is called New Earth Chronicles. Her name is Sylvia Ivanova. And I was so impressed with her work dealing with ancient cultures and analysis, etc., that I had her as a guest. And that show is available. You can just search it, the New Earth Chronicles, and look up McCanny, and you will come up with the show. It was in, I believe, 2017. So it was. You'll find it in my archives, in my own webpage, but then you'll find it also. And what they did is they took and put my interview with Sylvia in a YouTube video. And I usually don't post on YouTube videos, but this is an exception. So anyway, I encourage people to look at her channel because she has so much good information there. But she was a guest. And I had also invited Yvonne Whiteman, this author from England, who's writing about the Colburn, but she's a little more shy about being on radio, etc., does most of her work through writing. And so anyway, but those are the few guests that I've had on my radio show. Other than that, I really have not. I do my own radio show. I have my own material that I cover, and usually there's quite a bit of material for a one-hour show per week. Next week, I'll bring some of these other topics up. There's some other talk show hosts that I have not had time to, like Pastor Peter J. Peters, Robert David Steele. And what you'll find also is some of these talk show hosts are what you might call controversial. And that's okay. That's okay because our, when I was, say, with Alex Merklinger back in the early 2000s, he had a lot of controversial topics. We were talking about chemtrails. We were talking about weather manipulation. This is before anybody was bringing up these topics at all. It was before any of the people you commonly see talking about these topics today, before they ever even existed in the realm of discussing these topics. So, and then Peter J. Peters, of course, is a controversial person, a pastor, radio pastor, and he has a very hardcore view dealing with the powers in the world, and he calls it the way he sees it. And of course, unfortunately, he died. He was overcome by some kind of an illness. And I sometimes wonder if when some of these people pass away, that there's a little help from our friends, if you want to know what I mean, whether it was Malachi Martin or Pastor Peter Peters or Robert David Steele, another person. I was on his show quite a bit. He had an untimely demise and clearly with some extenuating circumstances, we'll just put it that way. But I'll be back next week talking about some of these other topics. But when people ask me a lot of times why I am involved with certain people, I call it swimming with the sharks. You have to be in the water in this industry. And it's an industry, it's a business, but it's a business of getting my information out. So at any rate, I'll be back next week with more of the history of my discoveries, etc. Once again, visit my webpages, jmccsci.com, jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McKinney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.